This is number six. Now that we have examined the manager's job and we identified certain managerial functions, as you will remember, it's appropriate at this juncture in our discussion to consider the process of managerial decision making. Decision making has to be a part of all managerial jobs. A manager makes decisions constantly as he or she performs the functions of planning, organizing, staffing, directing, and controlling. I think we could say that decision making is the process of making rational choices among alternatives. It's not a function of management, but rather it is a common thread within the five manager functions which we have mentioned. Managers, of course, make big and small decisions every single day. Whether or not they realize it, they go through a process to make those decisions. Whether planning a budget, organizing a work schedule, interviewing a prospective employee, watching a worker on the assembly line, or making adjustments to a project, the manager is performing a decision-making process. The decision-making process has seven steps. They're logical and simple in themselves, but they are all essential to the process. Perhaps we could mention these, and then we will develop them in greater detail. First step is to define the problem. What is the particular problem that you have to resolve? Defining the problem is the critical step. The accurate definition of a problem affects all the steps that follow. If a problem is defined inaccurately, then every other step in the decision-making process will be based on that incorrect point. A motorist tells a mechanic that her car is running rough. Well, this is a symptom of a problem, or perhaps of several problems. The mechanic begins by diagnosing the possible causes of a rough-running engine, checking each possible cause based on the mechanic's experience. The mechanic may find one problem, perhaps a faulty spark plug. This is the problem. Changing the plug will result in a smooth-running engine. If not, then the problem still exists. Only a road test will tell for sure. Finding a solution to the problem will be greatly aided by its proper identification. The consequences of not properly defining the problem are wasted time and wasted energy. There are also the possibility of hearing, "What? That again? Well, we just solved that problem last month, or at least we thought we did." So, number one, define the problem. And then, perhaps a second item that could be mentioned. Identify the limiting or the critical factors. Once the problem is defined, the manager needs to develop the limiting or critical factors of the problem. Limiting factors are those constraints that rule out certain alternative solutions. For example, one common limitation is time. If a new product has to be on the dealer's shelves in 1 month, any alternative that takes more than 1 month will certainly be eliminated. Resources, personnel, money, facilities, and equipment are all other common limiting or critical factors that narrow down the range of possible alternatives. So number one, define the problem. Number two, identify the limiting or critical factors. Number three, develop potential alternatives. At this point, it's necessary to look for, develop, and list as many possible alternatives, that is, solutions to the problem, as you can. These alternatives should eliminate, correct, or neutralize the problem. Alternative solutions for a manager faced with the problem of trying to maintain scheduled production may be to start an extra work shift, to schedule overtime on a regular basis, to increase the size of the present workforce by hiring employees, or to do nothing. Doing nothing about a problem sometimes is the proper alternative, at least until the situation has been analyzed thoroughly. Occasionally, just the passing of time provides a cure. So, define the problem, identify the limiting or critical factors, develop potential alternatives, and then analyze the alternatives. The purpose of this step is to decide the relative merits of each of the alternatives. What are the positives? What are the negatives of each alternative? Do any alternatives conflict with critical limiting factors that you have identified earlier? Well, if so, they must automatically be discarded. Then select the best alternative. At this point, the alternatives have been listed along with their corresponding advantages and disadvantages. Which should be selected? Sometimes the best solution is really a combination of several of the alternatives. Trying to select an alternative or combination of alternatives, a solution must be found that appears to offer the fewest serious disadvantages and the most advantages. Care should be taken not to solve one problem while at the same time creating another. And then implement the solution. Managers are paid to make decisions, but they're also paid to get results from these decisions. A decision that just sits there hoping someone will put it into effect may as well have never been made. Everyone involved with it must know what he or she must do, how to do it, why it will be done, and when. In addition, a good alternative applied by uncommitted persons is a half-hearted way, and it will often only create additional problems rather than solve them. Like plans, solutions need effective implementation to yield the desired results. People must be sold on their roles and know exactly what they must do and why. Programs, procedures, rules, or policies will be put into effect thoughtfully and thoroughly. And then, establish a control and evaluation system. The final step in the decision-making process is to create a control and evaluation system. Ongoing actions need to be monitored. This system should provide feedback on how well the decision was implemented, what the results are, if they're positive or negative, and what adjustments are necessary to get the expected results. For a manager who uses this decision-making process, the probability of successful decisions should be improved. Why would we say that? Because it provides a step-by-step roadmap for the manager to move logically through the decision-making process. These steps again. Number one, define the problem. Number two, identify the limiting factors or the critical factors. Number three, develop potential alternatives. Number four, analyze the alternatives. Number five, select the best alternative. Number six, implement the solution. And number seven, establish a control and evaluation system. Dr. Kenneth Gangle has made some interesting statements in discussing the leader and process of decision making. I'd like to share some of his statements with you. Some contemporary scholars within the area of management theory have developed the concept that the leader's principal task is not basically concerned with decision making. They would see him rather structuring conditions which serve as a context in which subordinates and others within the organizational structure make decisions. Well, it would appear that this is not only an idealistic proposal, but in many cases it's actually undesirable. Since the responsibility for much implementation rests ultimately upon the leader himself, the decisions which brought about that implementation should also be traceable to the person who bears the responsibility. It's possible, of course, for the leader to delegate the authority for decision-making, and this, of course, is done in some processes of delegation. Suffice it to say at this point that decision-making is here to stay in almost any realm of management. Certainly the process of decision-making does not occur in a vacuum. It is indeed a part of administration, management, and organization. Nevertheless, because of its importance, it must be emphasized. I think there are probably some causes for ineffective decision-making. Indecisiveness has ruined the effectiveness of many managers. Well, what produces it? What causes an individual who seems to have the ability to perform a given task to stop short of shouldering the responsibility for making important decisions? Ineffective decision-making consists basically of two problems. First, the hesitancy to make any kind of a decision. And second, the making of an inferior decision. Both of the negative results can be traced to several basic causes. But what are some of these causes? Perhaps we could say one of the causes would be a lack of clear-cut objectives. Sometimes leaders don't act because they don't know what to do. Socrates is reported to have said, "We have a much better chance of hitting the target if we can see it." When objectives are clarified and specified, decisions generally are made in such a way as to achieve those objectives. So one reason that we have negative results in decision making is a lack of clear-cut objectives. And then another reason is insecurity of position or authority. Sometimes a leader is afraid to act for fear of the consequences. And then a third reason that sometimes we have these negative results in decision making is a lack of information. Decision making is a difficult process when no alternative seems clear, or when all alternatives seem equally clear. Sufficient information must be brought to bear upon the problem to narrow the alternatives. Decision making is inseparably related to the process of selection among alternatives. Dr. H. Edward Rapp, Associate Dean for Management Programs at the University of Chicago, emphasizes this fact. He states that Sirt and March contend that in real life, managers do not consider several possible courses of action, that their search ends once they have found a satisfactory alternative. My sample of good managers is not guilty of such kinds of thinking. Unless they were mulling the wide range of possibilities, they could not come up with the imaginative combination of ideas which characterize their work. The obvious purpose of limiting information is to demonstrate that some of the possible decisions which could be made are less valid than others. Sometimes such information will immediately focus on one of the courses of action as the best. At other times, the limitations will chop away the possibilities until only one respectable alternative remains. The leader who does not actively seek all of the information that he can get before rendering his decision is crippling himself in the decision-making process. So again, what are these causes of ineffective decision-making? Well, Dr. Gangle says sometimes it's lack of clear-cut objectives or insecurity of position or authority, or perhaps a lack of information. One other item he mentions is the fear of change. Whether or not they admit it, many leaders actually desire to retain the status quo. Since most decisions produce some kind of change, they represent a constant threat to present modes of operation. The more radical the decision, the more change will result in the form of subordinate reactions. In other words, what will people say? But when these expected attitudes or opinions become detrimental to effective decision-making, they must be brought into proper perspective. So, again, what are the causes, or some of the causes, of ineffective decision-making? Number one, lack of clear-cut objectives. Number two, insecurity of position or authority. Number three, a lack of information. And number four, a fear of change. But let's think for a moment about decision-making and really the problem-solving process itself. When decision-making is viewed basically as a process of problem-solving, certain steps can be delineated which describe the mental activity through which the leader passes to solve the problem. This activity can be outlined in different structures, and what we present here is only one proposal. The first three steps represent the process of studying the decision. The next three steps relate to making the decision, and the seventh and final step has to do with testing the decision. So decision-making and the problem-solving process. First of all, consider the orientation to the situation. How does the leader get familiar with the background of the problem and the context under which the problem has arisen? First of all, we might assume that he has some general experience in the area. In fact, his experience and knowledge are the very factors which have elevated him to the position of leadership. One important feature that during the first step of problem-solving decision-making is deferred judgment. Deferred judgment must be practiced. This is the study stage, not the acting stage. So there must be, in this decision-making, problem-solving process, there must be an orientation to the situation. Then secondly, there must be an identification of the key facts. It is important for a leader to realize that he probably will never have all of the facts in any given decision-making situation. It's necessary for him to sift through the information which he receives in order to isolate and study these key facts. To this particular step of the process, he brings acute observation of the problem and a careful sifting of the information which he has gathered. One facet of this second step is effective questioning of people involved. Such questions should be open rather than closed. In other words, they should be questions which allow the respondent to tell what he knows rather than answer yes or no as if he were a witness in a trial. They should be leading questions rather than loaded questions. Instead of gunning for answers which he thinks he may want, the leader should ask as a catalyst, hoping to stir important facts loose as people reply to the questions. Such questions should always be cool rather than heated. Some problem situations may literally aggravate the leader. Parents will often reply to children, "Why did you do that?" using that question almost in the act of scolding rather than really attempting to get a legitimate answer. Effective questions are also planned rather than impulsive. It may be necessary for the leader to think by himself for a while before actually plunging into the problem that has been brought to him. Whom should I ask? How shall I approach him? When would be the best time to raise the issue? These and similar questions he will ask himself as he prepares to identify the key facts. One additional criteria might be added to the evaluation of problem-solving questions. They must be window questions rather than mirror questions. That is, they should be geared to allow the administrator to look through clear glass into the problem rather than to reflect any opinions or prejudices that he may be tempted to bring to the problem. And then as we think about this decision-making, problem-solving process, not only must there be an orientation to the situation, not only must there be identification of the key facts, but then there must be an identification of the major problem or problems. Of course, not all decisions are problem-solving decisions. Some merely relate to the selecting of the course of an action. When an identifiable problem is present, however, it is essential to identify that problem before it can be solved. Well, how does one go about such identification? Look for causes rather than symptoms. The leader must assume that all behavior is motivated. Sometimes the motivation may be internal. Sometimes it may be external, caused by friction by other people in the organization. Difficulties or discomfort at home, or perhaps some physical malady of which the particular worker may be unaware. The whole process of counseling may enter the decision-making situation at this point. Isolate the sections through deductive reasoning. Deductive reasoning proceeds from the general to the specific, and then open-mindedly weigh all the evidence. Certainly naive to assume that all of the evidence which presents itself in response to any given problem is accurate in its relation to fact. Even evidence provided by his superiors must be weighed by the leader as he considers the identification of the real problem. As we move from the identification of the major problem or problems, the next step would be the proposal of possible causes and the identification of one or more solutions. The emphasis in the first part of step three was the identification of causes. Now we focus on the specification of those causes. The leader should be able to verbalize the problem and the proposed solution. Edge's criteria for good teaching objectives can well be applied to the proposal problem causes in the decision-making process. The solutions offered should be brief enough to be remembered, clear enough to be written down, and specific enough to be achieved. Sometimes a specific problem will never appear as the leader works his way through steps 3 and 4 of the decision-making process. When that is the case, he proceeds to generalize on past successes, he applies the process of inductive reasoning, and he makes his decision in light of the accepted principles of sound administrative theory. So again, we are considering this decision-making and problem-solving process. We said, first, there must be an orientation to the situation. Secondly, there must be the identification of key facts. Thirdly, there must be the identification of major problems or problems. Then there must be a proposal of possible causes and the identification of one or more. Then there is the listing of probable solutions. The listing of probable solutions in the problem-solving process consists of engaging in creative brainstorming, the rules of which are simple, and the reward is usually quite satisfactory if the process is carried out properly. Notice the following guidelines. In brainstorming, quantity breeds quality. This is another way of saying that the more ideas a person has, the more likely he is to come up with some good ones. The process of coming up and sharing and having multitudes of ideas is basic to the process of problem solving. And the leader must approach this task with sufficient openness of mind to allow many and varied possibilities to present themselves. In brainstorming, one solicits as many ideas from others as possible. This is a throwback to the questioning process of step two. Here, however, the goal is not merely to identify the facts involved, but to procure suggestions from people who may have something solid to offer. It is, in effect, a continual asking of the question, what would you do in this situation? Brainstorming does not allow for evaluation at this point. Should the leader ask for the opinion of a coworker regarding a situation, receive a reply, and then react by saying, well, how would it work in this situation? He's rendering insignificant some information which may have helped him in the next step, and he's also stifling future contributions from this individual. At this point in the process, the assumption is made that almost anything will work to solve the problem. When the list of possible solutions is as long as it can be made, one then begins to evaluate the solutions. And this brings us to the next step of testing, selection, and application of the best solution. In the testing of possible solutions, the leader asks such questions as, will it work? Will it be accepted? Is cost a prohibiting factor? Is this solution permanent or merely a stopgap action? On the basis of his testing process, he selects the solution which best seems to fit the case. It has been suggested that the selection of proposals requires a high tolerance for ambiguity. For example, three evaluative questions which can be applied in the testing and selections of a solution are discussed here. Considering each proposal, the general manager tested against at least three criteria. First, will the total proposal, or more often will some part of the proposal, move the organization toward the objectives he has in mind? Second, how will the whole or parts of the proposal be received by the various groups and subgroups within the organization? Where will the strongest opposition come from? Which group will furnish the strongest support? And which will be neutral or indifferent? And then third, how does the proposal relate to programs already in process or currently proposed? Can some parts of the proposal now in front of him be added to a program already underway? Or can they be combined with all or parts of other programs in a package which can be steered through the organization? When the solution has been decided upon and a decision has been made to move in a certain direction, the leader must avoid holding back or obvious apprehension about the decision. Very often such a reaction will exist within his own mind, but confidence toward colleagues and subordinates is important in the implementation of the decision. Also, it is essential that all affected parties be informed immediately.